A senator visiting Kyiv vows Washington will continue providing aid to Ukraine no matter who comes out on top in next week's U.S. midterm elections.
Clearly, what's going on here in Ukraine is something that Republicans ought to focus on because it's in our national security interest. Think of the consequences if Vladimir Putin is allowed to succeed.
Plus, Ukraine's president says millions were temporarily without power Thursday. What measures are being put in place to mitigate the stress on the battered electrical system? And later in the program, as American basketball star Brittany Griner heads toward a Russian penal colony, what can she expect? Today is Friday, November 4th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian forces can't retake the strategic southern city of Kherson from Russian troops. That's according to U.S. officials on Thursday. If Ukrainian forces do so, it would mark a major defeat for Russia in its invasion of its neighbor. On the same day, the deputy head of the Russian-installed administration in the Kherson region urged residents to leave the city. It was a video address that was recorded by the Moscow-appointed official Kirill Stremovsov and shared on Thursday via Telegram, showing people in the streets and supermarkets. Tens of thousands of civilians have also been evacuated from the city of Kherson in the face of a Ukrainian counteroffensive. However, Ukraine fears that Russia, which has said it may withdraw its troops from Kherson, is merely setting a trap. Reuters' Lisa Bernhard is up first.
In what would be a major defeat for Russia in its war against Ukraine, officials are now saying that Ukrainian forces are capable of retaking the strategic southern city of Kherson from Russian troops. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the Pentagon on Thursday.
Most importantly, the Ukrainians believe that they have the capability to do that. We've seen them engage in a very methodical but effective effort to take back their sovereign territory.
Austin's remarks coincided with a Russian-installed official in the Kherson region saying that Moscow was likely to pull its troops from the west bank of the Dnipro River, which, if confirmed, would signal a significant retreat for Moscow. The region's capital and river port is the only big city Russia has captured intact since its invasion began in late February. But Ukraine said it was still fighting in the area and was wary that Russian forces were setting a trap by pretending to pull out. Previously, Russia had vehemently denied it was planning to withdraw from the region, which President Vladimir Putin claimed to have annexed to Russia at the end of September. Meanwhile, in the northeastern city of Kharkiv, Ukrainian servicemen fired rockets at multiple Russian positions. Kharkiv in recent days has been hit by Russian missile and drone strikes, targeting infrastructure and causing blackouts. And in the capital of Kyiv, two U.S. senators, Democrat Chris Coons and Republican Rob Portman, vowed that bipartisan support from the U.S. would continue for Ukraine after next week's midterm elections.
The United States has long been a nation that fights for freedom, and this is the most important fight for freedom in the world today.
The visit comes amid speculation that the Republicans, seen as favorites to take control of at least the House of Representatives, could dampen U.S. support for Ukraine, something Portman appeared to refute.
Clearly, what's going on here in Ukraine is something that Republicans ought to focus on because it's in our national security interest. Think of the consequences if Vladimir Putin is allowed to succeed.
That was Reuters reporter Lisa Bernhard. Some 4.5 million Ukrainians, more than 10% of the pre-war population, were temporarily without power on Thursday evening because of Russian attacks, according to President Volodymyr Zelensky in a video address. He said that it is important now to maintain the ability to act together. He also told local authorities to ensure that there's no unnecessary use of electricity in all the cities and communities of Ukraine. And joining us from Kyiv is Anna Chernikova. Anna, so I guess where I want to begin on this Friday is, what is the government doing to ensure people abide by these requests? And as someone who is living in Kyiv, one of these affected regions, what is life like there now as these Russian attacks on the civilian infrastructure continue?
The government has introduced almost a month, actually, this balancing of the energy system. So this has scheduled power shortages, which people are experiencing in different regions, in particularly in the city of Kyiv itself as well. What I can say that these outages, they started to be more often this week. So previous week, it was not that much in around Kyiv, if we talk about Kyiv. But this week, it's almost in every district. I actually think it's in every district. And it's at least three times per day. So these schedules are working. In some districts, they work better. In some districts, they work worse. But in my district, for instance, it's quite a good scheduling. So all the outages are according to the schedule. And for the moment now, I have an energy outage, electricity outage for 1 hour, which was under the schedule. And I'm expecting the power back in around 3 hours. And also another very important steps that Ukrainian government is taking is communication with international partners, and particularly with U.S. partners, in terms of getting protection support and also equipment support to restore these facilities and to help Ukraine to restore these facilities. Particularly yesterday, I was at the press conference of Senators Portman and Kunz in Kyiv, and they were talking about this, particularly about this case. And they were talking about this, that U.S. will also be paying a very precise attention to this sector, and this would be one of the main priorities. And my question to them was exactly about this, about this energy outage situation, and how U.S. partners in particularly can help Ukraine. And they said that this would be considered as a priority, and that steps would be taking, including air defense systems, equipment support supply for energy facilities, and also help, humanitarian help for people who suffer of these shortages, because of course situation in Kyiv is much better than if we talk about, for instance, Donetsk or Kharkiv regions, where these cuts are much worse.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani met Friday at the Group of Seven summit in Munster, Germany, to work on the very strong partnership between the two countries. Blinken commented on the progress made during the G7, including collaboration regarding Russia's aggression toward Ukraine, common approaches to China, and climate change.
We had an opportunity over the last day or so to deepen our collaboration together and deepen our collaboration with our G7 partners on everything from Russia's aggression against Ukraine to our common approach to China, to many efforts to help bring peace and stability to different parts of the world where Italy and the United States are engaged together, working as well on a strong climate future and energy future for our countries and others. But on these and on so many other things, Italy and the United States are speaking with one voice and speaking strongly as well for the democratic values that we share.
And of the two countries' commitment toward Ukraine, Tajani said,
"Peace is impossible without justice. Justice is the freedom of Ukraine."
Top diplomats from the world's major industrialized democracies continued to meet on Friday to strengthen unity on Russia's war in Ukraine, China's growing global economic clout, and Iran's crackdown on anti-government protesters. The meeting in Munster comes nearly a year after the same G7 nations banded together to warn Russia of massive consequences if it went ahead with its plans to invade Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Friday said that Russia's confrontation with Ukraine was inevitable. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg met with Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu in Istanbul on Thursday. Addressing reporters, Stoltenberg said it was time for Finland and Sweden to join the NATO alliance. But Turkey's foreign minister said that Sweden and Finland have not yet fulfilled all obligations under a deal clearing their bids to join NATO, and that they must still make concrete steps in order to do so. Sweden and Finland signed a memorandum in June, resulting in NATO member Turkey lifting a veto of their applications to join the Transatlantic Security Alliance. The two asked to join in response to Russia's war in Ukraine, but Turkey sought extra guarantees. And joining us from Istanbul is VOA's Dorian Jones. Dorian, thank you very much for joining us. Both Sweden and Finland had memorandums of understanding that Turkey would not oppose their joining of NATO. So I guess what I want to ask you is, what does Turkey want to happen that would allow it to further support the addition of these two countries to the Transatlantic Treaty Organization? And what do they hope to get out of next week's visit by the new Swedish government to Ankara?
Well, Ankara's primary concern has been that these two countries, and in particular it's Sweden that Turkey has its main problem with, is that they're not cracking down on organizations which Turkey considers as terrorist organizations. Now, primarily, that is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, which is in Europe and along with the United States designated as a terrorist organization. Ankara claims that there are many operatives that continue to work in Sweden. And also, there are other groups that Turkey blamed for a failed coup in 2016, an organization called FETÖ. Again, Ankara says that Sweden is not cooperating or cracking down on this group, although Sweden doesn't recognize this as a terrorist organization. So basically, Ankara wants more cooperation on the security field and cracking down on these groups. And very controversially, is looking for extraditions. And it presented Sweden with a long list of people they want extradited back to Turkey. Many of them include Swedish citizens. And this is all a matter for the Swedish courts. And in fact, Swedish government have said that this is a legal matter, not a political one. But that's not cutting much ice with Turkey. So they really feel that they are not getting enough cooperation. And they are looking to this new government led by Ulf Kristersson, which is more on the right of the political agenda, for further cooperation. But it has to be said, speaking to people here, many believe that there's not going to be a final agreement by Turkey until the June-July summit next year of NATO. And why then? Because that will be after a general election in Turkey. I mean, the belief here is that President Erdogan wants to string along NATO until that election, because he knows it plays well with his electorate, standing tough against NATO and the West among his nationalist conservative base. And also he sees it as an opportunity of extracting further concessions down the road to help him in his re-election bid, which is really facing a tough challenge.
Dorian, on a separate matter, I wanted to ask you about the grain deal, which is set to expire on November 19th, unless Russia renews it. And it says that it hasn't made a decision one way or the other, but this is also coming as both Turkey and Russia have announced that they're going to implement some sort of free grain transportation to countries that truly need it, like Djibouti and Sudan. So where do things stand, not only with this free grain program, but with discussions to renew the Black Sea Grain Initiative?
Well, we don't know too much about how this free grain deal will work, other than it will be President Putin and Erdogan in the conversations have highlighted that the countries that will receive it will be Djibouti, Somalia, and Sudan. And as you said, they are all facing major famines. How the actual the sending of this grain and who will actually pay for it is very unclear. And in fact, Erdogan said that they will discuss this in great detail at the G20 summit in Indonesia later this month. But Putin earlier said, interestingly, this week, that if this grain deal isn't renewed, then Russia would provide free grain to these countries outside of that deal. And I think this is what Moscow is positioning itself as possible leverage over negotiations. It's aware that if this grain deal collapses, the countries like Africa would be the ones that suffer the most. And Russia does seem to be taking some steps in coordination with Turkey to guarantee at least the food security for the countries which are in greatest need. And also Putin said if the deal was not to be renewed, Turkey would be exempt and they would continue to receive grain, which Turkey urgently needs as well. And this is all a positioning tactics, as you say, ahead of the renewal on November the 19th. This deal needs to be renewed by November the 19th. Russia is positioning itself for very tough negotiations. It's already laying out the demands for certain Russian banks to be exempt from international sanctions so Russia can sell its grain and fertilizer. These are all indications of very tough negotiation. And Russia wants to, I think, is making it clear that it's not a done deal, that it will renew this deal. And I think Turkey is widely seen, and President Erdogan, as playing a pivotal role in efforts to renew that deal. That will enhance Erdogan's reputation internationally and also will stave off criticism of Erdogan that he's not enforcing Western sanctions against Russia. Erdogan says he can't do that and maintain his balanced role of a mediator between Putin and the rest of the world.
Dorian Jones reports for VOA from Istanbul, Turkey. Dorian, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Speaking about Russia's war of aggression on Ukraine, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said Iran is considering supplying Russia with ballistic missiles for its war on Ukraine, in addition to the drones Tehran has already delivered.
This is unacceptable. No country should provide support to Moscow in this illegal war. President Putin is failing in Ukraine, but he is responding with more brutality.
Iran had promised to provide Russia with surface-to-surface missiles in addition to more drones, and that's according to two senior Iranian officials as well as two Iranian diplomats speaking to Reuters News, but something that VOA has not been able to independently verify. However, White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara asked White House National Security Spokesperson John Kirby about that on Friday.
We haven't seen any indication that they've transferred any other weapons or technology, for instance, surface-to-surface missiles, but we're watching this as best we can. The mere fact that Iran and Russia are talking about the possibility for additional capabilities, be they UAVs or be they missiles, just shows you how much more isolated both countries are from the rest of the international community. And it shows you how desperate Mr. Putin's becoming with his own defense industrial base, that he has to rely on outside suppliers like Iran and now potentially North Korea.
President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Thursday that he would not take part in a summit in Indonesia of the group of 20 major economies if Kremlin leader Vladimir Putin attends. Zelensky told reporters after talks in Kyiv with Greece's president that he had been invited to participate in the November 15th and 16th summit by Indonesian President Joko Widodo. Earlier this week, President Vladimir Putin said that Russia will be present in some high-level capacity at the G20, but he said that he is still thinking about the forum in which that will happen. As U.S. basketball star Brittany Griner faces a Russian penal colony, one woman says it's a world in which she is intimately familiar with, Maria Alyokhina. She's a member of the famous feminist music group Pussy Riot, who spent 2 years in a penal colony for a punk protest against Russian President Vladimir Putin. The first thing to understand, she says, is that a penal colony is no ordinary prison. Reuters' Trevor Carroll brings us the story.
Pussy Riot, the Russian feminist art ensemble and protest group, is a famous name in that country. And now, as American basketball star Brittany Griner faces a 9-year drug sentence in a Russian penal colony, one of Pussy Riot's members tells Reuters that this is a world she knows all too well. Because she was an inmate in one herself for almost 2 years, for her part in a punk protest against President Vladimir Putin. Maria Alyokhina is now on world tour after fleeing Russia. She says the first thing to know about a Russian penal colony is that it is no ordinary prison.
This is not a building with cells. This looks like a strange village, like a gulag labor camp. It actually is labor camp, because by the law, all the prisoners should work. And quite cynical thing about this work is that prisoners usually sew a police uniform and uniform for Russian army almost without salary. Prisoners have usually 4-5 euros per month, and they work 6 days a week, 8 or 12 hours per day. All of that without normal food, without normal medicine system and without any human rights defense. Do not leave someone alone with this system, because, as I said before, it's totally unhuman. It's gulag. And when you feel yourself alone there, it's much easier to give up. I never seen anyone who doesn't speak Russian inside the system. I have no idea how she will be, how she will, what she will feel. But it's quite tough experience, and she should not go through it alone.
While on tour with her band, Alyokhina has recounted long spells in solitary confinement and punishment for minor infractions like an unbuttoned coat. She also encouraged Griner's supporters to send letters and cards, saying that the small taste of the outside world offered her a rare ray of hope while she was an inmate. She says that if it's sent in both English and Russian translation, even if it's just a computer translation, that it will get past prison censors easier. Russia's prison service did not respond to Reuters' request for comment on this story.
Trevor Carroll of Reuters News. Ever since Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th, the war-torn country has also been receiving support not just from Ukrainians living abroad, but also from people who have no seeming connection to Ukraine. Michael Gonelli is the mayor of the eastern U.S. state of New Jersey's city of Syracuse, and he's among those supporters. Anna Rice narrates this story to round us out.
Oksana Bats is a Ukrainian activist living in the New Jersey town of Secaucus. From here, Bats says she's doing what she can to help people in her homeland. And she says so is the town's mayor, Michael Gonelli, even though he has no personal connection to Ukraine.
He answers our every plea for help. We come and say, Michael, we need so-and-so, and he just says, no problem.
Michael Gonelli has been the mayor of Secaucus for over 13 years. He admits before Russia launched its war on Ukraine, he knew very little about the country. But when residents came forward asking for help, he quickly agreed.
We're doing another fundraiser this week with them at the town pool. We do a lot of fundraising for them, and now we just, they're part of my life now. They're really part of everything that we're about.
Ukrainian Daria Herasimenko has lived in Secaucus for over 16 years. Originally from Dnipro, when the war started, her parents, niece and sister, all lived in Ukraine. Her family came to the U.S. in May, after the start of America's Uniting for Ukraine program, which makes it easier for Ukrainian citizens fleeing the war to enter the U.S.
I didn't want them to wait until a missile hit our town. We lived close to Donetsk, and you just never know.
Herasimenko's parents, Nina and Vladimir Herasimenko, left Dnipro in March. They voiced gratitude for all the things the town has done for Ukrainians.
The kid walks in the street and sees Ukrainian flags. This makes us so happy.
Though safe and happy, but Daria Herasimenko's parents, sister and niece came to the U.S. with nothing. And again, the mayor and community helped them through. A few years ago, Mayor Gonelli partnered with businesses that sell clothing, household items and shoes, and that agreed to donate some of their goods to charity.
The mayor would call us and say, come into the store. There are new clothes. They're brand new.
On August 24th, Ukraine's Independence Day, Gonelli flew the Ukrainian flag right next to the U.S. flag. The mayor said the flag will remain in the city center until Ukraine wins the war. For Irina Salonko in New Jersey, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up with the latest developments in Ukraine and around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media feeds. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.